A federal judge is ordering U.S. prosecutors to release a list of, quote, unindicted co-conspirators in the George Washington Bridge lane closure scandal. I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. WHYY's Joe Hernandez starts us off in New Jersey.
The list contains the names of people the U.S. Attorney's Office believes were involved in a politically motivated scheme to close lanes on the George Washington Bridge, but these people haven't been charged with any crimes. Two defendants, though, have been charged in the 2013 scheme, allegedly in retaliation against a Democratic mayor who didn't endorse Governor Chris Christie for re-election. Former Christie aide Bridget Kelly and Port Authority official Bill Baroni have pleaded not guilty. Another Port Authority official, David Wildstein, has pleaded guilty and is expected to testify. It's not clear yet how many people are on the list or when it will be released. The judge's ruling came in response to a lawsuit filed by a group of media outlets, including the Associated Press. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
When shareholders gather for Comcast's annual meeting next week, it won't be at Philadelphia's Kimmel Center as in years past. As WHYY's Todd Bookman reports, the event will take place online.
Lots of major corporations are switching to so-called virtual shareholder meetings, in part to avoid scenes like this.
We vote no! We vote no! We vote no!
These protesters outside Comcast's 2014 annual meeting weren't happy with the company's plan to merge with Time Warner Cable. At the 2016 meeting, it's unlikely you'll find such discord.
You know, it puts them in complete control, and some boards and managers want to be in complete control.
James McRitchie is a shareholder rights advocate. He says online meetings strip away the ability to stand face-to-face with a CEO and ask him or her direct questions.
It's like going to see the dictator speak.
But John Deming, a spokesperson for Comcast, says a virtual meeting allows shareholders from around the country to attend at no cost.
We believe it'll provide expanded shareholder access and participation in it, also more improved communications, and over time, cost savings for our company and the shareholders.
Some firms are choosing a middle ground, having both a physical event and an online one. David Yermak researches corporate meetings at NYU. He says it isn't clear just what impact virtual events may have on dissent.
There's a history of hundreds of years of shareholders figuring out how to use these meetings as a platform to embarrass the managers of the firm. And I think with a new technology, I wouldn't underestimate modern activists' ability to use the platform to their own benefit.
Comcast's meeting takes place online next Thursday. For WHYY News, I'm Todd Bookman.
At least 4% of all defendants sentenced to death in the United States between the years 1973 and 2004 were innocent of the crimes for which they were convicted. The same 2014 National Academy of Sciences study researchers believe that the rate of innocence must be higher still for those guilty of murder, but not given a death sentence. Does Philadelphia resident LaFaye Gaskins, now serving life without parole, fall into that category? Investigative reporter Dan Denver spent 2 years looking into Gaskins' case and joins me now on Newsworks Tonight. Dan, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Dan, take us back to that day and the circumstances that are known about Albert Dodson's murder.
So Albert Dodson was a drug dealer from Virginia, and he was up in Philadelphia to buy a large quantity of cocaine. His frozen body in February 1989 was found in an abandoned Mantua home. He had a gunshot wound to the face. He had a large amount of money in his coveralls, and that's all they had at that point. Gloria Pittman lived across the street. She told police that she was preparing to get high at the time. She had seen three men across the street laughing and talking, and then she heard what she thought was a gunshot. She told police very clearly that she did not see the face of the man or men, depending on which account, running from the abandoned house after she heard the gunshot. When police brought her in for a formal interview, they showed her a photo lineup that included a photo of LaFaye Gaskins. She did not identify it. She said that she did not see anyone's face. Police then asked her to look at a second set of photos. The only photo that she was shown twice in a row, apparently, was a photo of LaFaye Gaskins. She then identified it. At the preliminary hearing, she again said she'd never seen Gaskin's face. Somehow, the case was still held for trial. Finally, in the trial, she again said that she had seen Gaskin's face and identified him.
Now, the victim, Albert Dodson, knew the alleged perpetrator, Lafay Gaskins. How was Gaskins pulled into this case?
The drug dealer who Albert Dodson was allegedly buying cocaine from was a man named Wayne Rodney Hampton, who goes by the name Junie. And Junie and Lafay Gaskins were close friends from North Philadelphia. There were allegations that Lafay Gaskins was Junie's bodyguard. Gaskins denies this. Gaskins fully admits that he was a drug dealer at the time as a young man in 1989. It seems that that connection to Junie is how police got interested in Gaskins.
Dan, you cite Seth Williams' role or lack thereof in getting Gaskins a new hearing. Has he had opportunity to read your report, or have you spoken to him directly on this matter?
Seth Williams' office refused to let me speak to Seth Williams about Lafay Gaskins' case. 2 years ago, he announced the creation of a conviction review unit to help right wrongful convictions. So far, it's amounted to pretty much a farce. His office could not point me to a single case where they had affirmatively helped to free an innocent person.
We are brought up with the saying, you're innocent till proven guilty, but it seems to be quite the opposite once one is convicted. And indeed, you cite Rob Warden, executive director and co-founder of the Center on Wrongful Convictions, as saying simply undermining the evidence is not adequate to overturn the conviction.
Exactly. If you're unlucky enough to be a poor person, especially a poor young black man, if you don't have a good lawyer who's able and willing to poke holes in the prosecutor's case at the time of your original trial, and you're convicted, once that door is closed, it's incredibly hard to get out.
Are you still in touch with Lafay Gaskins?
Yes, I speak to him every week.
At this point, as a friend, confidant, or also still continuing to try to shed light on his case?
Well, I've certainly grown close to him over the last 2 years. Initially, as I was reporting the case, I certainly did my best to maintain my objectivity. But once one has determined that the person that they're in communication with is set to die in prison for a murder that they very, very, very likely did not commit, it's hard not to have some personal sympathies get mixed in as well.
Dan, thanks so much for explaining this specific case and the general circumstances around it for our audience on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks very much for having me and for shining some light on this case.
Did Lafay Gaskins really murder Albert Dodson? The title of an extensive article by investigative reporter Dan Denver in the current Philadelphia Magazine. And you can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Still ahead, a long-standing promoter of the arts in Philadelphia finally has a show of her own work.
My mother was a suffragette. She believed that a woman had to take care of herself, but I happened to marry an artist who didn't know how to take care of himself.
We'll talk with Julia Zagar when Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY. Pipelines. They crisscross the countryside and lie scattered beneath the urban landscape. They bring us water, natural gas, gasoline. Well, what if someone came knocking on your door wanting to put a pipeline through your front yard? State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips takes a look at how eminent domain has entered the fracking debate.
We begin with Elise Gerhart, sitting up in a white pine tree on a platform about 40 feet high as chainsaws were roaring around her.
This is my home. You know, I grew up here. My parents owned this place 5 years before I was born.
Down below, police officers were guarding work crews and arresting her mother on her own land. So, what's going on here? This is eminent domain in action. The idea that the government can take land for the public good. That's why we, the public, get to enjoy national parks and drive on highways. But companies, and this comes as a surprise to many people, companies sometimes get the authority to take away private land. It certainly came as a shock to Elise Gerhardt.
It boggles my mind because it kind of goes against everything that you're taught, you know, growing up in America, and the American dream is to like own property. And as it turns out, these companies, these corporations can just come and take it away from you.
Right now, Sunoco wants 3 acres of the Gerhardt family land in Huntington County to expand a pipeline that will send natural gas flowing out of the Marcellus Shale 350 miles across Pennsylvania to the company's terminal near Philadelphia. At first, Sunoco said its plan was to export the gas to Scotland so it can be turned into plastics, which has Elise Gerhardt and some of her neighbors asking, what's the public good in chopping down her trees to make plastics overseas?
The world doesn't need more plastic, it needs more forests, bottom line.
When Sunoco officials were confronted with fierce opposition, their story changed. Now they're saying the pipe will benefit rural Pennsylvanians. Their new plan is to also unload some of the fuel along the way to help heat homes in Berks and Lebanon counties. The Gerhardts say Sunoco offered them $100,000 for 3 acres of their land, but they turned it down, saying it wasn't for sale.
Sunoco is a private for-profit corporation. They're not PennDOT widening a road that then we drive on. There's just no comparison here between this and that.
Sunoco wouldn't do a recorded interview for this story, but a spokesman says the company uses the power of eminent domain as a last resort when negotiations with individual landowners break down. And some landowners are happy with the money Sunoco paid them for their land and trees. But dozens of families, including the Gerhardts, are now in county-level courts across the state, either unhappy with the money Sunoco offered or battling the use of eminent domain for something they don't see serving the public good. And it's not just Sunoco. Pipeline companies are taking people to court all across the state.
It's totally insane what's happening. And nothing is sacred, like no conservation area, no business, no home, no school. They'll put these pipelines anywhere they want.
Ellen Gerhardt, Elise's mother, says the family bought the land more than 30 years ago with the intention of preserving it.
You can get up in the morning sometimes and look out your window and you've got deer in the front yard, you've got turkeys with their chicks. You know, it's just a nice, peaceful, quiet area.
Sunoco's power to use eminent domain in this case goes all the way back to a decision made by the state's Public Utility Commission in 1930. And for the most part, county courts have ruled in favor of Sunoco. But recently, a few courts have questioned that 86-year-old decision. And some eminent domain attorneys say the issue may not be resolved until it reaches the state Supreme Court. If so, it will be the job of the court to decide just how broad the power of eminent domain is in the state and how the public good is defined. Eminent domain attorney Rich Raiders represents about a dozen landowners who have cases with Sunoco, including the Gerhardts. Raiders boils it down to this.
The issue for the landowners is that this is David versus Goliath, and unfortunately, as a landowner, you are playing the role of David. And oh, by the way, Goliath is holding the slingshot.
In fact, Sunoco's eminent domain authority has allowed it to chop down trees even as the court battles continue. And while Gerhardt was able to save that one white pine tree she sat in, Sunoco crews did cut down 3 acres of trees.
We had tried everything else. We tried to make petitions and write letters and make phone calls and do research and go to meetings and fight it in the court system, and everything has failed us.
Now, Gerhardt is also worried about the safety of the pipeline that would run beneath her parents' land. Gerhardt's fears have grown since last month when a natural gas interstate transmission line exploded in rural western Pennsylvania, leaving one man with burns on 75% of his body and scorching 40 acres of farmland.
It seems crazy, right? That we have to do this.
Sunoco plans to begin construction on the pipeline this summer. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Julia Zagar has spent a lifetime supporting artists, and that includes her husband, the celebrated mosaic artist Isaiah Zagar. Now, she has a show of her own. Dear Julia is a show of Zagar's early ink paintings from the 1960s, as well as work by her husband and a network of Latin American artists that use her as a subject. The show is on view now at Philadelphia's Magic Gardens on South Street. WHYY's Peter Crimmins met with Julia Zagar in the Eyes Gallery. That's the shop she's run on South Street for 49 years. He asked her what she was doing 60 years ago.
I wonder what your ambitions were as an artist, because now you're known as someone who sells art, has a wide circle of artists, friends, and you're sort of a catalyst for art. But you're not really known as a person who makes art. So at this time, were you going to be a working artist?
I studied art. I was never wanting to compete in the commercial art field, but I was very deeply involved with expressing myself. But then life changed. I got married, but I also had children. My mother was a suffragette. She believed that a woman had to take care of herself. But I happened to marry an artist who didn't know how to take care of himself. So there was that knowledge. And then, being in the Peace Corps, I saw artifacts that I loved as much as my own work. You know, that I saw people who were working as well and as deeply as I was, and producing things that were better in certain ways than I felt I was doing, and certainly needed it more than me at that time.
They needed what?
I could help them more than I could help myself. I mean, when we came back from the Peace Corps, we came back with all the things we had bought. And that's how we started the Ice Gallery, because we had these beautiful things that we loved, that we had all picked, that we had picked out, and I mostly picked them out.
One thing in the show, we see, in addition to your work, we see portraits of you by Isaiah, and then recreations of those portraits by people mostly in Latin American countries. And I'm wondering how you feel about that. Well, first of all, you're the muse of your husband,
right.
And then he makes you the muse of other people entirely, and it's all you.
In our travels and in working with craftspeople and artists, we have seen that sometimes they get stuck. Artists all over the world, actually. They don't know what's the next step for them. They might have the facility, they might have the dream, but they don't know what the next step is. And they love to work with Isaiah. When Isaiah sat down and drew a picture, they really responded in an incredible way. They took those sheets of paper, and sometimes we've gone back now 30 years later, and they have the papers. They use it as their stimulus, and that's what it did. It stimulated. They don't go to school for art. They get it from their heritage, but the heritage goes up to a certain point, you know, and then they need new stimulation. We all do. And that's what those pieces are. So some of them have been pieces of pieces. In other words, stimulations of stimulations.
A big part of this show, where the title comes from, Dear Julia, well, we're seeing you as a subject of art.
Right. This is not where I want to be in the limelight. That's really not what I wanted. But if we could use it for a cause, it would be worth it. That would bring someone here and do a residency in Philadelphia, a woman artist who might have children and a husband that she has to support. So that was how it really grew.
Well, now that the show's up and you've seen it, what's your comfort level with seeing you up there?
I did it. It had to be done, and it was a wonderful two nights of opening, and very crowded, and I think we have almost enough money for the residency.
Well, Julia Zagar, thank you so much for talking to me.
You're welcome. It's good to have you here.
Julia Zagar speaking with WHYY's Peter Crimmins. The exhibition, Dear Julia, is now at Philadelphia's Magic Gardens on South Street. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.